face Superman style. "You want an answer?" I said. "Some of us stayed in town, man. Some of us don't run away from people we care about. We've been building something, Lily and me, for 6 months now. What the hell gives you the right to come out of nowhere and stomp on that now?" I thought about what to say to that, and nothing came to mind. "You're pathetic," Dan said. "You can't make a life for yourself out there. Go someplace else and leave us alone. You don't get another chance here." I exhaled, looking over at the Rodriguezes, who seemed highly entertained, then back at Dan. "Pathetic might be a little strong," I said.
"Fuck you."
"Lillian called me, Dan," I said, trying to keep my voice even, not the other way around. "If you were building something, I think it was collapsing way before I got here." In itself, that didn't strike me as that much of an insult, but there were at least 2 months of pent-up anger in Dan's first punch. I admit, I wasn't ready for it. It caught me square in the stomach. You don't ever want to fight an emotionally distraught person, especially one who's in good physical shape. What they lose in coordination, they gain in power and unpredictability. When he hit me, I had to ignore the nausea and the instinct to double over in order to avoid a haymaker swing that would have caught me in the head. I slid down under the punch, on my left leg, a little awkwardly, and used my right leg to knock Dan off his feet with a sweep kick. He didn't know to roll, so he fell on his back pretty hard. I got up and backed away. My gut felt like a piece of sheet metal that was hardening as it cooled. Dan scrambled up and started toward me. I held up my palms, offering a truce. "This is stupid, Dan," I said. He tried one more punch, but this time I was ready for it. I stepped out of the way and let him punch air. After that, he just stood there for a minute, breathing heavily.
"God damn it," he said. "You got no right."
He turned and started back toward his car. From the way he walked, his lower back must have been in a lot of pain. The windows of his BMW were tinted almost black, so it was only when Dan opened the door that I saw the older woman with bright gold hair sitting in the passenger seat. Her face rested in her left hand as if in total mortification. As the door slammed, Dan was growling to her,
"Don't start."
Then he drove over half the Rodriguez's front lawn and over the curb, getting back on the street. The BMW swerved slowly down Acacia like a drunk shark. The Rodriguez brothers looked at me and grinned, raising their beer cans in a salute. Lillian was in her bedroom pretending to read.
"Just a little man-to-man talk?" she asked coldly. "Did you mark off your territory for him?"
"Lillian," I started. I stopped, realizing I sounded like Dan had a few minutes before. She threw down her magazine.
"I don't like being told to go to my room while the big fellas fight it out, Trace."
"You're right. I should have let you handle it."
"You think I couldn't have?"
No answer would have worked, so I didn't try one. She got up and looked out the window. Finally, she walked over to me and put her arms around my waist. Her eyes were still angry.
"Look, Trace, this hasn't been a real great day for me. I think I need a hot bath and a night alone with a book."
"I love you," I said. She kissed me as lightly as you'd kiss a Bible.
"I think we should talk more tomorrow," she said quietly. "I don't want any more surprises from my past."
I closed the front door quietly on my way out. Back at home, I checked my newly installed answering machine. Mother had called twice, upset that I hadn't given her a report yet on my first date with Lillian. Bob Langston had left a cryptic message threatening me with bodily harm and legal action. I unwrapped the ceramic skeleton-driven car Lillian had given me and put it down on the carpet in front of Robert Johnson. He hissed at it, puffing up his tail as thick as a raccoon's, then walked backward into the closet, still staring at the new monstrosity.
2 days back home and I'd managed to mess up my fragile relationship with Lillian, aggravate my mother, traumatize my cat, and make at least 3 new enemies. Just about par, I told myself. There was only one other thing I could possibly stir up to make myself feel worse. I called directory assistance and asked for Carl Kelly, retired deputy sheriff, my dead father's best friend. Chapter 8.
I'll be damned, he said. I never thought I'd hear from you again, son.
Years of smoking hadn't been kind to Carl Kelly's voice. Every word sounded like it was being scraped across a metal file as it left his throat. Before I could tell him why I'd called, he began a long, gravelly sentence without periods telling me about all the people he and my father had known who were now either dead, in the hospital, or afflicted in their old age with ungrateful children. I got the feeling Carl was living alone now and probably hadn't gotten a phone call in a long time. I let him talk. One of God's little jokes. As soon as I had reached Carl on the phone, the TV program somehow switched from baseball coverage to a rerun of Buckner Fanning's morning sermon from Trinity Baptist. I dragged the phone across the living room as far as the cord would reach, and was now trying to reach the television controls with my foot, hoping I could either turn the set off or find another channel. So far, Buckner was thwarting my efforts. Tan and immaculately dressed, he was smiling and admonishing me to accept God. Yeah, I said to Carl at the appropriate moments. That sounds pretty bad. After a while, Carl presented me with an opening. He asked me what I was doing back in town. If I were to want some case files on Dad's death, who would I talk to? A long pull on a cigarette, a rumbly cough.
Christ, son. You've come back to look into that?
No, I said. But maybe now I could read about it fresh, more objectively, maybe put it behind me. I could hear him blow smoke into the receiver.
Not a week goes by I don't see him in my sleep, Carl said, lying there like that.
We both got quiet. I thought about that eternal 5 minutes between the time my father had fallen to the ground and the first paramedic unit had arrived, when we'd stood there, Carl and I, watching the groceries roll down the sidewalk with the lines of blood. I'd been completely frozen. Carl had been the opposite. He'd started pacing, rambling about what Jack and he had been planning on doing that weekend, how the hunting was going to be, what Aggie jokes Jack had told him the night before. All the while, he was wiping away tears, lighting and crushing cigarettes one after the other. A jar of jelly had rolled into the crook of my father's arm and nestled there like a teddy bear.
I don't know about putting it behind you,
Carl said. Buckner Fanning started telling me about his latest trip to the holy city of Jerusalem. Who would I talk to see the files, Carl?
It's in the house, son. And it's been too long. It just ain't done that way.
But if it was... Carl exhaled into my ear.
You remember Drapuski? Larry Drapuski? Made deputy lieutenant about a year ago.
What about for SAPD? He had a coughing fit for a minute, then cleared his throat.
I try Kingston in criminal investigations. If he's still there, he was always in debt to Jack for one favor or another. There was an FBI review of the case a few years back, too. I can't help you there.
I remembered neither Drapuski nor Kingston, but it was a place to start. Thanks, Carl.
Yeah, well, sorry I can't help much. I thought you were my son calling from Austin. He ain't called in over a month, you know. For a minute there, you sounded like him. Take care of yourself, Carl.
Nice way to spend an afternoon, he said. You kept me talking all the way up to 60 minutes.
I hung up. I couldn't help picturing Carl Kelly sitting in some house alone, a cigarette in his withered hand, living for television shows and a phone call from Austin that never came. I sat for a minute, Robert Johnson instantly in my lap, and we watched Buckner talk about spiritual healing. Then I turned off the set. Chapter 9.
Little Trace! Larry Jepuski laughed. Jesus! Not the same 7-year-old kid who used to sit on my desk and eat the custard out of the middle of my donuts.
As soon as he said that, I had a vague memory of Jepuski. A large man, flat-topped red hair, friendly smile, a sweating face that looked like the Martian landscape. His big hands always full of food.
Yeah, I said, only 20 years and a lot of donuts later, nobody calls me little.
Join the club, the lieutenant said. So, what's on your mind?
When I told him why I was calling, he was quiet for an uncomfortable amount of time. An oscillating fan on his desk hummed back and forth into the receiver.
You understand everybody has looked at this, Larry said. Half the departments in town, the county, the FBI, everybody wants a piece of this. You want to find something that nobody's caught before, it isn't going to happen.
Does that mean you won't help?
I didn't say that.
I heard papers being moved around on the other end of the line. Finally, Larry swore under his breath.
Where's the pen?
He asked somebody, then to me.
Let me have your number, Trace.
I gave it to him.
Okay, he said. Give me a couple of days.
Thanks, Larry.
And Trace, this is a personal favor. Let's just keep it personal.
You got it. He cleared his throat.
Yeah, well, I owed your dad a lot. It's just that the sheriff is sensitive to taxpayer dollars being used on, let's say, non-essential work. It also doesn't help if it's about one of his predecessors who beat him in 3 straight elections, you know what I mean?
I checked with SAPD next. After a few minutes of being transferred from line to line, I finally got Detective Schaefer, who sounded like he'd just woken up from a nap. He told me Ian Kingston, formerly with Criminal Investigations, had moved to Seattle 2 years ago and was presently overseeing a large private security firm. Kingston's ex-partner, David Epcar, was presently overseeing a small burial plot in the Sunset Cemetery.
Wonderful, I said.
Schaefer yawned so loud it sounded like somebody was vacuuming his mouth.
What was your name again?
He asked. I told him.
Like in Jackson Navarre, the county sheriff that got killed?
Yeah. He grunted, evidently sitting up in his chair.
That was the biggest pain in the ass we've had since Judge Woods took a hit, he said. Fucking circus.
It wasn't exactly a show of sympathetic interest. Seeing as I was out of other options, however, and had to say something before the detective fell back asleep, I decided to give Schaefer my best song and dance. Much to my surprise, he didn't hang up on me.
Huh. Call me back in a week or so, Navarre. If I get a chance to look at the files, maybe you can ask me some questions.
That's mighty white of you, Detective. I think he was snoring before his receiver hit the cradle. By sunset, it still wasn't cool enough to run without getting heat stroke. I settled for 50 push-ups and stomach crunches in the living room, then held horse stance and bow stance for 10 minutes each. Robert Johnson lounged across the cool linoleum in the kitchen and watched. Afterward, I lay flat on my back with my muscles burning, letting the air conditioner dry the sweat off my body and listening to the dying hum of the cicadas outside. Robert Johnson crawled onto my chest and sat there looking down at me, his eyes half closed.
"Good workout?" I asked.
He yawned.
I unpacked a few boxes, drank a few beers, watched the fireflies floating around in Gary Hales's backyard at dusk. I tried to convince myself I wasn't fighting any kind of compulsion to call Lillian. Give her some time. No problem. It was just coincidence that I kept staring at the phone. I started digging through my box of books until I found Lillian's letters, wedged in between the Snopes family and the rest of Yaknapatawpha County. I read them all, from her first in May to the one that had arrived last Thursday, just as I was packing. Reading them made me feel much worse. Irritated, I dug around in the box some more, looking for some lighter reading material, Kafka maybe, or an account of the Black Plague. What I found instead was my father's scrapbook. It was a huge, canvas-covered, three-ring binder, stuffed with just about every insignificant piece of writing that he'd ever scribbled, but was too lazy to throw away. There were yellow drawings he'd done for me when I was 5 or 6, stick figures of armies and airplanes that he'd used to illustrate his drunken Korean bedtime stories to me. There were letters that had never been mailed to friends who had long since died. There were pages of notes on old cases he'd been pursuing that meant nothing to me. There were grocery lists. I still have no idea why I'd taken the scrapbook from his desk after the funeral, or why I'd kept it, or why I decided to look at it again now. But I sat down on the futon with it now and started flipping through. In several places I dog-eared interesting pages, most of which I'd forgotten about. One of them caught my attention. A yellowed piece of spiral paper, the kind of scrap my dad was always leaving around the house, filled with rambling reminders to himself. It appeared to be a list of notes for a trial testimony he was making against Guy White, a suspected local drug trafficker. Then at the bottom it said, "Sabinal, get whiskey, fix fence, clean fireplace." This page had bothered me the first time I read it, and it bothered me now, though I wasn't sure why. It wasn't just Guy White's name. I remembered White's drug trial vaguely, then later some speculation that White's mob connections might have been behind my father's murder, but Dad's testimony notes revealed no shocking secrets. The 7 words Dad had scrawled at the bottom of the page bothered me more. They sounded like a reminder of what to do next time we went to the family ranch outside Sabinal. Except, we only went to Sabinal at Christmas for deer season, and the notes were written in April, a month before Dad died. I finished off my 6-pack of Shinerbach while I read, and felt almost grateful when my father's shaky cursive started to blur. I'm not sure when I actually fell asleep, but when I woke up, it was full dark and the phone was ringing. I almost impaled myself on the ironing board trying to get to the receiver. "Hello?" I said. My mind was fuzzy, but I could hear the sounds of a bar in the background, glasses clinking, men talking in both Spanish and English, a jukebox playing Freddie Fender. No one said anything into the receiver. I waited. So did the caller. He waited much too long for a typical prankster or an honestly confused drunk with a wrong number. "Leave," he said. Then the line went dead. Of course, it was just the fact that I was half asleep, probably still half drunk, and that I'd been thinking about things way too much. But the man's voice sounded familiar to me. It sounded a little like my father. Chapter 10. The next morning I made the mistake of practicing Taiji sword in the backyard. By 9 o'clock, I had served as breakfast for a small army of mosquitoes and scared the neighbors half to death. The woman next door came outside in a blue terry cloth bathrobe around 8:30, dropped her coffee cup when she saw me swinging the blade, then went back in and locked the door. She left the coffee cup broken on the back porch. Across the alley,
Two pairs of large, dark eyes were following my movements cautiously through the mini-blinds on the second floor. Finally, Gary Hales shuffled out in his pajamas and asked me in a listless voice what I was doing. He might have been sleepwalking for all I could tell. I stopped to catch my breath. "It's a kind of exercise," I said. He blinked slowly, looking at the sword.
"With big knives?"
"Sort of. It makes you exercise very carefully."
"I reckon so."
He scratched behind his ear. Maybe he was trying to remember why he'd come outside. "You think maybe it's better if I don't practice out here?" I suggested.
"I reckon maybe," he agreed.
Before I went inside, I looked up at the people behind the mini-blinds and pretended to stab at them with the sword. The lifted slat flicked down instantly. After a shower, I tried Lillian's number and got her answering machine. I figured she was in transit to work, so I tried an old number for Carlin McGaffrey at the Express News. I was bounced back to the main operator for the newspaper, who told me Carlin was now working for the Friday Entertainment section. She transferred the call.
"Yo,"
McGaffrey answered.
"Yo,"
I said. "Is that the way all you slick entertainment writers answer the phone? Or do you just have trouble with words over one syllable?" It took him three beats to place the voice.
"Navarre?
Do the words piss off mean anything to you?"
"Not when you hear them as often as I do."
"Hang on," he said. He covered the phone for a second and yelled at someone in his office.
"Okay," he said. "So where the flying fuck have you been the last decade or so?"
Carlin and I had been in high school together, then had worked for the A&M newspaper in college. He played the star journalist while I, one of the very few human beings ever to major in both English and physical education, had written a sports editorial column. Young and stupid, we drank to excess and terrorized the cows of Bryan, Texas, by pushing them down hills while they slept with their legs locked. After I moved out to California my sophomore year, we had eventually lost touch.
"Believe it or not," I said, "I'm back here seeing Lillian."
Carlin whistled.
"Sandy over at the Society page is going to love that. She's been getting a lot of mileage out of Lillian and old Dan the Man Chef lately."
"You put my picture on the same page as the debutantes and I'll rip your nuts off."
"I love you too," he said. "So why the warm and friendly call if not to fill me in on your romance?"
"Tell me about the newspaper morgue. I'm looking for information on my father's murder and the investigation."
"That was what, 84?
85. He asked someone behind him a question I couldn't catch.
"Yeah," he told me. "Anything before 1988 is still on microfiche. After that, we joined the computer age, public access, but it would be a lot faster if I got one of the mole people down in archives to round it up for you."
"That would be great, Carlin."
"So you owe me. What else is new?"
"Now, tell me. Why are you digging up family history, Navarre? I thought you wanted nothing to do with that." The tone of his voice told me the question was more professional than personal.
10 years makes a difference," I said, "especially if I'm back here to stay."
"You got something new on the case?"
"Nothing that would work for the entertainment section."
"I'm serious, Trace. You got anything on the case? I'd like to know."
"This from a man whose biggest scoop in college was a breakthrough in onion-growing technology."
"Some friend," Carlin said, and hung up. I tried Lillian's studio and got Beau Carnow instead. At first he pretended not to remember me. Finally he admitted that Lillian was not in.
"When do you expect her?" I asked.
"Day after tomorrow."
I was silent for a moment.
"I don't think I got that."
"Yes, you did,"
Beau said. I pictured him smirking. It wasn't a pretty image.
"She went on a buying trip to Laredo, left a message on the studio machine this morning. I might add it's the least she can do after stabbing me in the back like she's doing."
"Yeah, you might
add that, mightn't you? The least she can do. Drops everything in my lap, thinks she can actually make a living. He had more to say, but I put the receiver down on the ironing board. He might be talking to himself for hours before he figured out I was no longer there. When my mind started aching this bad, I knew it was time to abuse my body instead. I put on running shorts and a Beta Breakers t-shirt, then headed down New Braunfels toward the Botanical Center. The really hot part of the day was yet to come, but after 2 miles I was drenched in sweat. I found a little stand that sold coconut paletas and bought one, letting the icy chunks of fruit slide down my throat as I sat in the shade of a pecan tree near the entrance to Fort Sam Houston. I stared across at the Army base, wondering if Bob Langston was in there somewhere, laughing about a prank call he'd made to me last night. I hoped that was the case. When I got back to Queen Anne, the phone was dead from being off the hook so long. Evidently, Beau had finally got tired of his own voice. I put the receiver back in the cradle. I did push-ups and crunches, then decided to tackle cleaning the kitchen. The memory of Bob Langston lived on in the fruit keeper of the refrigerator, where several black bananas had turned into oblong mounds of mush. He'd also left 2 sandwich bags filled with some kind of meat slices, congealed in what I assume had been a barbecue sauce. Not even Robert Johnson was interested. The place was looking almost clean by that evening when the phone rang.
"I'm very close to being pissed off," Jay Rivas said. "In fact, I'm downright perturbed, Navarre."
"I'm not a qualified therapist," I warned him.
"Maybe there's some kind of inferiority complex for incompetent, bald, fat men with large mustaches.
Or maybe there's some kind of asshole who keeps smearing his shit all over town where I have to step in it."
I sighed. "Do you have a point to make, Jay?" He blew smoke into the phone.
"Yeah, kid, I got 2 points. First, yesterday evening you assault a young man whose family is heavyweight on the Chamber of Commerce. Said young man will not press charges, otherwise you and I would be having this chat in person right now. Second, I hear about you digging for information on a 10-year-old murder, bothering people who have better things to do than help you come to terms with your fucking manhood."
I counted to 5 before answering. "You're talking about my father's murder. I think I've got a right to know."
"You had a right to know 10 years ago, Rivas shot back. "Where the fuck were you when it mattered?"
There were a lot of things I wanted to say to that, but I waited. Finally, Rivas swore under his breath.
"Look, Navarre, let me save you some time. On the record, nobody can prove who whacked your old man, okay? You're not going to get the goddamn case files, but if you did, that's what they'd tell you. Off the record, it's no big secret. Your dad spent the last 2 years of his life putting thumbscrews on the mob in Bexar County. It's one of the few things he did well. The mob finally hit back. Nobody can prove it. Everybody knows it. That's the short and shitty truth, and after all this time, nobody's going to do any time for the killing. So unless you've got some indisputable reason why this case needs to be looked into again, which you don't, and the goodwill of the SAPD, which I promise you, you don't, then you lay off. Go marry your high school sweetheart and get a nice job teaching college somewhere, but stay the hell out of my sight."
He hung up. I stared at the wall for a while, seeing Jade Rivas's face. I thought about Lillian's sudden trip to Laredo, the way our reunion wasn't quite going as I'd planned, the way Maya Lee had sounded on the phone, and the way people kept sending me these loving phone calls. When I put my fist through the sheetrock, I missed the stud by less than an inch. I think it surprised me more than it did Robert Johnson. Clearly unimpressed, he stared up at me from his nest of freshly unpacked clothes on the futon. I checked for broken knuckles.
"Ouch," I told him.
Robert Johnson got up and stretched. Then he showed me the kind of sympathy I was used to. He left the room.
Chapter 11.
Yielding to Robert Johnson's hungry cries Tuesday morning, I walked to Leon Pappy Delgado's grocery on the corner of Army and Broadway. The rest of the block had gone up for lease years ago, but it restored some of my sense of universal justice to see Pappy's Christmas lights still blazing around the pink doorway of his dilapidated adobe storefront. My father, always suspicious of any store larger than 2,000 square feet, had been a patron of Pappy's for years. But since I'd spoken no Spanish when I left San Antonio and Pappy knew little English, we had never said a word to each other beyond Buenos Tardes. He was amazed, maybe a little suspicious, when I started talking to him en español. He rubbed his paddle-shaped nose, perplexed, then gave me a crooked grin.
San Francisco, he said. You talk just like my wife's brother now, Señor Tres.
As I searched in vain for Robert Johnson's brand of food, Pappy told me about his 7 boys and 2 girls. The youngest had just had her confirmation. The oldest was in the Air Force now. I looked in my wallet after paying for my 2 small bags of food. It was a sobering moment.
"So what are you doing back in town, Señor Tres?" asked Pappy.
"It would seem," I said, "that I'm looking for a job."
"Always need counter help," Pappy said, grinning.
I promised to keep it in mind. Back at home, I found the list of leads Maya had given me and started making calls. After an hour on the phone, I'd talked to a 12 voicemail services, 1 receptionist who couldn't spell my name but was free on Saturday night, and 2 personnel directors who promised not to throw my resume in the trash if I mailed it in.
"And you say you're a paralegal?"
the last man on the list asked me. He had graduated from Berkeley with Maya.
"Not exactly." "Then what is it that you do?"
"Research, investigation. I'm bilingual. English, PhD, martial artist, congenial personality." I could hear him tapping his pencil.
"Maya employed you for what, then?
Discussing literature, breaking arms?
You'd be surprised how few people can do both."
"Uh-huh." His enthusiasm was not overwhelming.
"Do you have a Texas PI license, then?"
My work for Terrence and Goldman was more informal than that.
"I see."
His voice seemed to be getting farther and farther away from the receiver. "Did I mention I was a bartender?" To prove it, I started giving him the recipe for a pink squirrel. By the time I got to the sugar on the rim, he'd hung up. I was taping over the hole in my wall and pondering my limitless job opportunities when Carlin McGaffrey called from the Express News.
"Shiloh's," he said. "1 hour, you're buying."
When I got there at 1 o'clock, the little downtown deli was still packed with businessmen gorging themselves on the pastrami and rye lunch special. The air was so thick with the smell of spiced meats, you could get full just breathing it. Carlin waved at me from the counter. He'd put on at least 20 pounds since I'd last seen him, but I could still recognize him by his tie. He never wore one with fewer than 12 colors. This one had enough pastel to repaint half the west side. He smiled and pushed a thick manila envelope across the counter toward me.
"When the mole people start digging, they don't mess around. I got everything, even some copy from the light. We inherited most of their archival material when they went defunct."
The first thing I pulled out was a picture of my dad, taken the last year he'd campaigned for sheriff. Those gray, mischievous eyes stared back at me from under the rim of his Stetson. He had an amused look on his face. I always wondered how anyone could see a photo like that and willingly vote this man into public office. Dad looked like the quintessential third-grade class clown, only older and fatter. I could imagine him cutting off little girls' ponytails with his schoolbox scissors or throwing spit wads at the teacher's back. The counter waitress came by. I decided to skip the lunch menu and go straight for Shiloh's cheesecake, 3 layers thick, any of which by itself would have been the best cheesecake in the world. I ate it while I skimmed through the rest of Carlin's envelope.
There were lots of headlines about my dad's last big project in office, a multi-department sting operation against drug trafficker Guy White that had eventually gone down as the most expensive failure in Bexar County law enforcement history. According to the articles, the case against White was finally thrown out of court on a ruling of entrapment, just weeks before my father's murder. Dad won lots of friends on the federal level by telling the press that the FBI had botched the whole operation. There was an ongoing series of guest editorials from The Light, written by another of my father's great admirers, Councilman Fernando Asante. He blasted my father for everything from abuse of police power to poor taste in clothes, but mostly Asante focused on the sheriff's opposition to Travis Center, a proposed hotel tourist complex for the southeast side of town. Back in 85, Asante was making Travis Center the centerpiece of his first campaign for mayor, pushing the idea that the complex would generate tourist dollars in the poor, largely Hispanic section of the city. My father opposed the project because it would require the annexation of county lands, and more importantly, because it was Asante's idea. Then there was a report on the fall 85 election results, which Dad didn't live long enough to see. The voters showed a healthy sense of humor by voting against Asante for mayor 5-1, but approving his Travis Center bond initiative by a landslide. Now, 10 years and umpteen million dollars later, Asante was still just a councilman, and Travis Center was finally complete. I'd seen it from above on my plane's final approach, a huge, bulbous structure, hideously painted pink and red, cutting a gash in the hills on the edge of the town like a giant flesh wound. Finally, there were stories about the assassination. There, in black and white, were all the front-page headlines I had nightmares about, plus pages of follow-ups I'd never had the stomach to read. The murder scene, the investigation, the memorial services, all reported on in microscopic detail. Several articles talked about Randall Halcombe, the closest thing to a real suspect the FBI ever discussed in public. An ex-deputy, Halcombe had been fired by my dad for insubordination in the late 70s, then arrested in 1980 for manslaughter. Halcombe was paroled from Huntsville a week before my dad's murder. Convenient. Only by the time the FBI found him, 2 months after Dad's death, the ex-deputy was curled up in a deer blind in Blanco, shot between the eyes. Inconvenient. The last thing in Carlin's files was a photo of my father's body covered with a blanket, his hand sticking out the side like it was reaching for a beer, while a grim-faced deputy held up his hand to block the camera, a little too slow. I resealed the envelope. Then I stared at the neon beer signs over the bar until I realized Carlin was talking to me. "It's personal vengeance theory," he was saying. "Just some ex-con with a score to settle. That's bullshit. Christ. If Halcombe was acting alone, how come he turned up with a bullet between his eyes once the feds start looking for him?" I ate a piece of cheesecake. Suddenly, it tasted like lead. "You've been doing your homework, McGaffrey. You stay up last night reading these." Carlin shrugged. "I'm just saying there had to be a cover-up here." "Maybe that's the journalist in you talking. My ass! Your dad was murdered and nobody ever did time for it. Not even a fucking trial." "I'm just trying to help." Years of good living had softened Carlin's face a little, but you could still see the hard edge in his smile. His eyes were cold and blue. There was energy there, self-confidence, a harsh kind of humor. Nothing that might pass for compassion. He was still the same college kid who pushed cows down hills for fun and laughed shamelessly at racial jokes and broken limbs. He came through for his friends. He probably meant what he said about helping, but if he couldn't use it for fun or profit, it meant very little to Carlin McCaffrey. "Halcombe had his own motive," I reminded him, "assuming he's the one who did the shooting. He wouldn't have needed anyone pulling his strings." Carlin shook his head. "My money's on the mob. My sources at the SAPD tell me I'm right." "I heard that from the SAPD, too. Doesn't exactly inspire my confidence. Your dad died right after he brought Guy White in for trafficking, Trace. Don't tell me that was coincidence. Why should the mob target a retiring sheriff? That would be pointless. The charges against White had already been thrown out. Carlin wiped a piece of sauerkraut off his cheek. He was looking over my shoulder now toward the booths on the east wall of the restaurant.
Good question, he said. Go ask him.
Who?
Carlin pointed with the bottom of his beer bottle.
Guy White, man.
The booth Carlin was pointing at had two men in it. The one with his back toward me was a skinny, middle-aged Anglo whose mother dressed him funny. His slacks rode up at the ankles. His beige suit coat was too big around the shoulders, and his thinning brown hair was uncombed. He'd finished his meal and was now tapping a quarter slice of pickle absently on his plate. The man sitting across from him was much older, much more carefully dressed. I'd never seen Guy White in person, but if this was him, the only thing white about him was the name. His skin was carefully bronzed, his suit light blue, his hair and eyes as rich and dark as mole sauce. He had to be the best-looking man over 60 I'd ever seen. Mr. White was about halfway through with a club sandwich and appeared to be in no hurry to finish the rest. He was chatting with the waitress, smiling a Colgate smile at her, gesturing every so often toward his associate across the table. The waitress laughed politely. Mr. White's poorly dressed friend did not.
He comes in here twice a week to be seen, Carlin told me. Clean-nosed celebrity these days. Bailed the symphony out of bankruptcy, goes to the Alamo Dome for all the games, supports the arts, gets a picture taken with Manuel Flores at charity garden shows. Gone downright respectable. If something new came up in your dad's case, something that screwed White's public image to hell, that'd make a nice story.
I shook my head. You expect me to walk over there right now and confront him?
Where's that old college try? The Trace Navarre I knew would go up to an ROTC captain during live ammunition practice and tell him his girlfriend.
This is a little different, Carlin.
You want me to do it?
He started to get up. I pushed on his shoulder just enough to sit him back down on his stool.
What then? Carlin said. You asked me for the files. You must have some kind of theory.
I took one more bite of cheesecake. Then I stood, put the manila envelope under my arm, and left my last 20 on the counter.
Thanks for the info, Carlin, I said. Suit yourself, he said. But you want this thing covered in a friendly way, you know where to come.
I looked back at him one more time as I left. He'd pocketed my 20 and was ordering another beer on the Express's expense account. For a minute, I wondered why he had never gone into straight news reporting. He seemed disturbingly well-suited for it. Then it occurred to me that he was probably thriving right where he was, catering to the interests and appetites of the city in the entertainment section. That thought was even more unsettling. Chapter 12. 20 minutes later, I'd reparked my VW at the top of the Commerce Street garage, one row down from the dark green Infiniti J30 in Guy White's reserved monthly space. I knew White parked in the garage because it was the only logical place to park if you're going to Shiloh's. I knew he had a regular space because 10 minutes earlier a nice parking attendant had showed me the list of monthly parkers. In fact, he'd shoved it in my face, exasperated, trying to convince me that my name, Ed Beavis, was not registered. Normally I would have bribed him for the information I needed, but poverty makes for creative alternatives. A few more minutes of waiting, and the elevator door shuttered open. Mr. White's skinny associate in the ill-fitting beige suit walked out first, bouncing car keys in his right palm. He wasn't any handsomer from the front. His face had that sandblasted look farmers tend to get, dark pitted skin, permanently squinting eyes, features worn down to nothing but right angles. Mr. White strolled a few steps behind, reading a folded newspaper in one hand and smiling contentedly like there was nothing in there but good words. We started our cars.
Making no effort to hang back, I followed the Infinity out of the garage, then onto Commerce, and east for a mile to the highway. I couldn't see anything through the silvered rear window of Guy White's car, but once in a while my friend the driver would glance back at me in his side-view mirror. Tailing someone well is extremely hard. It's rare that you can strike the right balance between being far enough away to look inconspicuous and being close enough not to lose the subject. A full 90% of the time you'll lose the person you're tailing because of traffic or stoplights. Nothing you can do about it. Then you have to try. Try again. Sometimes for 7 or 8 days. That, of course, is assuming you don't want to be seen. Tailing someone badly is very easy. When I got about 15 feet behind the Infinity in the center lane of McAllister, the driver looked in his side mirror and frowned. I smiled at him. He said something to his boss in the back seat. If they'd sped up, they could have easily left me in the dust, but they didn't. I guess one guy in an orange Volkswagen wasn't their idea of terrifying. The Infinity kept cruising at an easy 50 miles per hour, finally taking the Hildebrand exit and turning left onto the overpass. I followed it into Olmos Park. Mansions started rising out of the woods and hills. Bankers' wives jogged by in warm-up suits that cost more than my car. The natives seemed to smell my VW as it went by. It looked like their noses weren't pleased. We passed my father's old house. We passed the police station. Then we turned off Olmos Drive onto Crescent, and the Infinity pulled into the red brick driveway of a residence I knew only by reputation. The White House. It wasn't just called that because of the man who lived there. The facade was an exact replica. Wraparound porches, Grecian columns, even the U.S. flag. It was an egomaniac's dream, except the whole building was scaled down to about half the size of the original. Still impressive, but after you looked at it for a while, it somehow seemed pathetic. It was a Volvo trying to look like a Mercedes. A Herradura bottle filled with Happy Amigo tequila. I pulled over on the opposite side of the road where the cactus and wild mountain laurels sloped down toward an old creek bed. The driver of the Infinity got out and started walking toward me. Mr. White got out next. He brushed some invisible speck off his powder blue suit, then folded his newspaper under his arm and began walking leisurely toward his front door, not looking back. The skinny guy came down the presidential lawn and across the street. He put his right hand on the side of the car and leaned in toward me. When his coat fell open, I got a pretty good view of the .38 air weight in the shoulder holster. "Trouble?" he asked. The number of vowels and syllables he packed into that one word told me he was a West Texas boy, probably hailed from Lubbock. "No trouble." I gave him a winning smile. Lubbock ran his tongue around his lips. He leaned in closer and gave me a short laugh. "I'm not asking if you got trouble, mister. I'm asking if you want it." I feigned bewilderment, pointing to my own chest. Lubbock's face turned into one big sour pucker. "Shit," he said. A three-syllable word. "You a retard, mister? What the hell you want following us like that?" I tried another dashing smile. "How about a few minutes of Mr. White's time? That's about as likely as pig shit. Tell Mr. White that Sheriff Navarre's son is here to see him. I think he'll agree to talk." If the name Navarre meant anything to Lubbock, he didn't show it. "I don't give a damn whose damn son you are, mister. You'd best get out of here before I decide."
"You've never been a highway patrolman." He scowled. It didn't improve his looks any.
"What?"
Before he knew what had happened, I'd grabbed the handle of his .38 air weight and twisted it, still in its holster, so the barrel was angled into the side of Lubbock's chest. His arms jerked up instinctively, like he was suddenly anxious for his armpit deodorant to dry.
All the tight lines in Lubbock's face loosened, and most of his color seemed to drain into his neck. "When you're stopping somebody in a car," I explained very patiently, "you never wear a shoulder holster. Much too easy to reach." Lubbock raised his hand slowly. His mouth was twitching in the corner.
"I'll be goddamned," he said.
Too many syllables to count. I got the air weight free of its holster, then opened the car door. Lubbock stepped back to let me out. He was smiling in earnest now, looking at the gun I'd leveled at his chest.
"That's the ballsiest son of a bitch move I've seen in a while, mister. I'll be damned if it wasn't. You just put yourself in so much deep shit you don't even know."
"Let's go see about getting you that raise," I suggested. The front door was painted white, with a bathtub-sized piece of beveled glass in the center. Lubbock led me through into a spacious entry hall, then left to a pair of double oak doors and into a private study. Somewhere along the way, he must have pressed a security buzzer with his foot, but I never saw it. Things were going very well, until the guy behind the coat rack clicked the safety of his gun off and stuck a few inches of barrel in my neck. Lubbock turned around and repossessed his .38 airweight. He never stopped grinning. The man behind me stayed perfectly still. I didn't try to turn.
"Good afternoon," I said. "Is Mr. White at home?"
"Good afternoon,"
the man behind me said. His voice came out smooth as honey over a sopapilla.
"Mr. White is at home, in fact. Mr. White is about to kill you if you don't explain yourself rather quickly."
I put my hand over my shoulder, offering to shake. "Jackson Navarre," I said. "The third." I counted to five. I thought that was it. I started to make peace with Jesus, the Tao, and my credit card agencies. Then I heard the safety click back on. Guy White took my hand.
"Why didn't you say so?" he asked.
Chapter 13.
"Would you pass me the blue princess, Mr. Navarre?"
Guy White pointed his trowel to the flat of baby plants he wanted. I passed them over. For his gardening ensemble, White had changed into a newly pressed denim shirt with the sleeves rolled up, Calvin Klein jeans, huaraches on his perfectly tanned feet. He traded the 9mm Glock for pruners and trowel. Shadows from the brim of his wicker hat crisscrossed his face like Maori tattoos as he knelt over a 5-foot plot of dirt, digging little conical holes for his new babies. Next to me on the hot stone bench, a jar of sun tea Guy White had brought out with us 10 minutes before was already dark amber. Sweat was starting to trickle down my back. My butt felt like a fried tortilla. I looked longingly at the nearby patio, shaded with pecan trees, then at the swimming pool, then at Guy White, who was smiling contentedly and humming along with the drone of the cicadas and not sweating at all. I'd liked him better when he was holding a gun on me.
"I'm quite excited about these," he told me.
He broke one plastic container off the flat of plants and turned it upside down to shake the roots loose.
"Do you know anything about gardening, Mr. Navarre?"
"It's not my specialty."
"That's some kind of verbena?"
"Very good."
"It was associated with sorcerers in medieval times."
White looked pleased.
"Is that so?"
He carefully placed the verbena into its new home and patted down the dirt. The little clusters of flowers were cotton candy blue. They matched Mr. White's ensemble perfectly.
"This is the first year the Blue Princess variety is available," he explained. "From England. It's only being offered commercially in South Texas. Quite an opportunity."
I wiped the back of my neck. "You always do your planting in the middle of the afternoon." White laughed. When he sat back on his heels, I realized for the first time what a large man he was. Even with me sitting and him kneeling, we were almost eye level.
Verbena is a hardy plant, Mr. Navarre. It looks delicate, but it demands full sunlight, aggressive pruning, well-drained soil. This is the best time to plant it. Many people make the mistake of pampering their verbena, you see. They're afraid to cut the blooms. They overwater or overshade. Treat verbena with gentleness, and it mildews, Mr. Navarre. One can't be afraid to be aggressive.
Is that your business philosophy, too? Is that the way it was 10 years ago?
Not a wrinkle marred Guy White's face. His smile was the smile of the redeemed, of a man with no troubles in this world or the next. I think, Mr. Navarre, that you may be operating under some faulty assumptions.
I spread my hands.
It wouldn't be the first time.
Maybe you could set me straight.
If I can.
His digging had uprooted a 6-inch earthworm, and when White stabbed his trowel into the dirt, it cut the worm neatly in half. White didn't seem to notice. He removed his leather gloves and took a long drink from his glass of iced tea before speaking.
I had nothing to do with your father's death, my boy. I feel better already.
White shook his head.
I'm afraid if you've inherited Sheriff Navarre's stubbornness, there's little point in our talking.
He made your life uncomfortable for several years. There are plenty of people who still say you got away with his murder. White pulled his gloves back on and started troweling the second row of Blue Princess. Under the shadow of his hat brim, his pleasant smile didn't waver at all.
I've been the convenient answer for many criminal questions in the past, Mr. Navarre. I'm aware of that. In the past, exactly. Would you hand me the 1959, please?
Pardon?
The fertilizer, my boy, next your foot. You may not know that in recent years I've done my best to give back to the community. I'm pleased to be thought of as a good citizen, a patron for many causes. I've been actively cultivating that role, and I much prefer it to the undeserved reputation I had in my younger days. I'm sure.
Murdering, drug dealing, hardly the sort of thing you can talk about at the Kiwanis Club. White stabbed his trowel back into the dirt, up to the handle this time. He was still smiling when he looked up, but the lines around his eyes revealed just a bit of frayed patience.
I want you to understand me, Mr. Navarre. Your father never made my life as difficult as it was after he died. When I was subjected to all sorts of scrutiny, all sorts of witch hunters looking for someone to blame for his murder. I've worked for many years since then to build back my position in the community, and I am not anxious to have that position compromised with groundless speculation that should have been put to rest long ago. I hope I'm being clear.
While White was talking, Lubbock had ambled across the lawn. He was now standing respectfully a few yards away, holding a cell phone, waiting to be summoned forward. White let him wait.
Do we understand each other? White asked.